Yeah, so the equation, it was first published in PRL in 30 years ago on March 3rd. So last Thursday, you may have seen that we had a birthday party. We actually have a video that's being made of the party, including a cake that had one of the experiments involving the KPC equation on it. So this will be a talk. So I'm a mathematician, but I'm going to try to give you kind of a little bit of the mathematical take and a little bit of the physics take that's been present in the program that that we've been running for the last 2 months. Let me start by writing down the KPC equation. So it's a nonlinear stochastic PDE, which is composed of a smoothing term. So this term, so H is supposed to represent some sort of function of time and then a single spatial variable. So this T is positive and this is a real value spatial location. And this takes values in R. And then there is a term which is some sort of smoothing of the height function. Then there is a nonlinearity. I'm putting in some coefficients which control the nature of these terms. So this is going to be a nonlinear dependence on the local slope. And finally, there's some noise. This is going to be noise. So the picture that you should have in mind is that you have some sort of rough interface. You can think of this as the boundary of some sort of growth process. Maybe you can imagine, since it's raining, if it was about 30 degrees colder, you might have something like freezing rain coming down, and then you would look at a windshield, and there's some nice things online where you can actually watch this, and you would look at the interface formed by this growing frozen rain. Or you can look at some sort of bacterial colony growing outwards or some liquid crystals growing. In any case, you want to understand how such an object might grow. And so this H is representing at a given time what this height function is. And each of these terms has a role. So first of all, there's a local growth. So you have local growth. Smoothing means that you kind of tend to smooth out these big minimums and big maximums. But then this nonlinearity, it can also be thought of as somehow implying that growth always occurs in the normal direction to the slope. So there is this nonlinear dependence on the local slope. You don't always just grow up at the same speed. You see what the local slope is, and that affects the overall growth rate. And then this is supposed to represent some sort of random noise. And so throughout this symbol will represent a Gaussian white noise, which is a Gaussian process which is totally uncorrelated in space and time. So the expected value of this is a delta function in space and delta function in time. Now, what I will do during the course of this talk, so I'm going to try to make sense of three questions, so the questions for today. So the first question will be, really, what does this mean? In other words, as a mathematical object, as a stochastic PDE, how do I actually make sense of what this equation is doing? And it's going to be complicated because you can see you're inserting a lot of noise into the system. And the noise is making the interface very rough. And so from the beginning of the story, it's not at all clear how to take a derivative and square it, because things are too rough to make sense. So there's some regularization. So I'll be very brief, and I'll tell you what this means. I'll focus more on the second and third question. So the second question will be basically, how does this arise? So what type of systems is this really supposed to model? And perhaps more precisely, is there some sense in which I can take a system and rescale it to get this equation? And the third question will be, how does it behave? So this equation was introduced, and the reason it's gotten so much traction is it was introduced as a model for randomly growing interfaces. But you really want to understand, what do randomly growing interfaces behave like in their large time, long scale limit? And perhaps what other types of systems does this model? So that's what I'll come to. Now, in these three questions, there'll be a bonus, which we'll start to see, which is part of why this has really captured the interest of mathematicians a lot, which is that there is immense and very beautiful structures. So there are certain structures, mathematical structures at play. And I'll only very briefly touch on two of them. I really won't touch on the first, I'll just mention it. The first is, in studying the equation as a stochastic PDE, there's a very nice thing called regularity structures, which were introduced by Martin Heyer, and for which he won a Fields Medal recently. So this is a mathematical structure which, in part, came out of studying equations of this type, which has gotten a lot of traction. Now, more on the side of actually computing statistical behavior, computing the long time limit, the behavior, there are other structures which has given rise to something called integral probability. So I'll touch also on the role that integrable systems plays in the study of this equation. Okay, so let's go methodically. So we're going to start with one. And the question was, what does this mean? So let me tell you how to define a solution to the KPZ equation. So as I said, initially, this subject is too rough to actually directly make sense of the equation because of the nonlinearity. So the natural thing to do is to smooth, as one does, so smooth the noise. So I'm going to smooth the noise. I'll say that I introduce some delta function, some approximate delta function, and I'm going to convolve the noise with it. So this will be a delta function in space of width kappa. And so it will be something like this. And its width will be kappa, and the height will be 1 over kappa. So all I'm going to do is I'm going to smooth the noise a little bit in space. And now the equation makes total sense, because if you have smooth noise in space, then the solutions will be smooth, and these derivatives will make sense, and everything of that sort. So here's a theorem. This was proved in the early 90s by Bertini and Cancrini, which says that once you've smoothed the equation, let me just choose the parameters to be kind of canonical parameters. The choice of parameters actually doesn't matter. As we'll see, you can scale throughout them. But for what I write, it will be. And then consider solving. So solve this KPZ equation with this smooth noise. And now you get a solution. And take, so we're going to subtract some diverging constant. So subtract a constant times t. So this constant is related to the smoothing. This is the value of the smoothing involved with itself at zero. So you subtract that constant from the solution, and then take kappa to zero, and you get a canonical object. You get a single object, regardless of how you smooth, and this object is actually identified as the logarithm of the stochastic heat equation, so where z solves the stochastic heat equation, which is written here. Okay, so the content of this theorem says the following, which is that you just smooth the noise, regardless of how you smooth the noise. If you subtract off the right divergence and you take the smoothing to zero, you get back the same universal object. And that universal object can be identified as the logarithm of the solution to this stochastic heat equation. Now, this stochastic heat equation no longer is nonlinear, and it is a perfectly well-posed object. In other words, you can perfectly define what it means to solve this equation. There's no problems at all. Okay. In fact, you don't even need to just smooth in space. So you can, there's a theorem of Martin Heyer using these regularity structures that you can smooth in time as well. So you should think of this as some sort of ultraviolet, small scale cutoff, and then a renormalization that's required in order to make sense of the object. Okay. So whenever we really talk about the case...
Could you say physically, what do you mean smooth in space? I mean, is the noise...
So the noise is...
Is it going to be at a single point? Is that a true delta function limit you're taking there?
Yeah, so initially you're dealing with true delta function correlation. And all I'm saying is call that a smooth delta. And then remove that. Okay. So physically it's like, you know, you're going to just smear things out a little bit. And then you're going to remove the smearing.
So this choice of no and that is just the point where the x terms cancel?
The choice of these?
So on that side, if I plug in that log z, the x, z squared terms cancel?
That's right. So you can formally, just if you just applied the chain rule, then you would get this.
Right.
But this equation doesn't make sense. This equation makes sense. So in order to do the chain rule, you need to first smooth things.
Okay, that's mathematics. So this miracle happens just at this one point.
In the lambda and
for new lambda,
nu.
For new
lambda.
No. In fact, for general lambda and nu, you can also you just get a different coefficient.
Because you rescale.
Yeah, you just rescale everything. So in fact, this choice is totally generic, as I'll show in a moment.
So you have the form h equals not log z, but z is some power that depends on nu and lambda.
So
for any nu and lambda.
For any nu and lambda, you have the same type of relation.
But you have to rescale a.
You need to
rescale.
Yeah, you need to rescale time and space and stuff like that. Yeah. So I'll write down I'll write down exactly what will answer your question. Okay. So.
The original equation becomes a little bit different from the original one. You started from that stochastic heat equation with a diverging constant, right? In some sense.
Yeah. So another way of thinking of it, if you smooth here, and then you take the logarithm, then you're going to get back the KPZ equation, but with a diverging constant. That's what you're saying. Yeah. It's another way of thinking about it. Okay, so this is kind of a very brief foray into the how to actually define the object. Now I want to make sense of how does it arise. And so this will talk about how do you scale the KPZ equations. How does the KPZ equation behave under scaling? So let's define an object I'll call H epsilon. And this will answer the question of what this nu end and beta choice meant, which is essentially nothing. So I'm going to just scale generically time and space and also the solution. So I can always choose that space will be scaled by epsilon to the minus 1. Time will then be scaled by epsilon to the minus z for some z which we won't specify quite yet. And then I'll scale the whole solution by epsilon to the beta. And then you find that this rescaled solution satisfies a rescaled equation. Write it down. So here's the Laplacian. Now what's interesting about this rescaled equation is that each term rescales differently. So what it means is that you can generically, by just scaling time and space and the solution, you can get between any choice of coefficients and any other choice of coefficients. There's an important caveat, which is that this is not the same noise as you had at epsilon equals 0, because you're kind of smooshing everything. Space-time white noise has certain scale invariances up to some coefficients that come out, and so when you do a rescaling by epsilon, you get a rescaled noise. So it's not kind of the same noise as you had before. So what can we learn from this? Well, the first thing that we can learn is that the KPZ equation has no doesn't scale to itself. In other words, the KPZ equation is not a fixed point in its own right. Another thing we can start to learn is the following. We can start to understand maybe what might be the scalings under which the KPZ equation has non-trivial behavior. So here's a fact, which I won't prove, which is that Brownian motion is invariant for the KPZ equation. In other words, if you start out with a solution which is Brownian in space, you run the equation, at a later time, you'll again see a solution which is Brownian in space. up to a random height shift. Now, what that suggests is that if you want to kind of maintain that invariance property, if you're going to initially at time zero have space scaled by epsilon to the minus one, then you ought to also scale h by epsilon to the 1/2. In other words, the scaling under which Brownian motion remains invariant. So the natural thing, so this suggests that we should choose the parameter b is equal to 1/2 in order to see something non-trivial as epsilon goes to zero. In other words, in the long time large scale limit. Now, once you plug in epsilon equals 1/2 into these equations, you find that the only way that no term blows up, none of these coefficients blows up, and yet not all go to zero, is to choose z is equal to 3/2. If you choose any other choice of z, then either every term will go to zero, in which case you would imagine under that choice of scaling, you just get nothing, or one of the terms will blow up to infinity. So this...
In the late time limit.
In the epsilon goes to zero limit, which is the late time limit. So this is a very kind of crude argument that to see something non-trivial, you should take these two choices, which in other words, I like to think of as 3-2-1 scaling. You take time, which has an exponent of 3, well, 3/2 here, space, epsilon of 2/2, and then the fluctuations, exponent of 1, which is 1/2 here. And this is the kind of prediction you would get out of this very naive argument for how in long time large scale limits the KPZ equation should show some non-trivial behavior. Now, a lot is hidden, and a lot is kind of not present in this heuristic. For instance, if you really just plugged in these two parameters, you can see how each term behaves. So this term behaves like epsilon to the 1/2, which seems to go to zero. This term behaves like epsilon to the 1/4, which also seems to go to zero. And this term is 2 - 3/2 - 1/2. So this term is just fixed. So what you would naively be led to believe is that under this scaling, h epsilon converges to the solution of dth is equal to the square of the gradient of h, and that's called the Invissit-Burgers equation. Okay. That's a deterministic equation. That's not true. We know that Brownian motion is invariant, but Brownian motion is not invariant for the Invissit-Burgers equation. So there's something much more complicated occurring. And what really happens is somehow, even though the noise seems to be disappearing, it's getting magnified through the nonlinearity, and it's going to survive in the epsilon goes to zero limit. And you're going to converge to an object, which is called the KPZ fixed point. Now, I'll tell you a little bit about this object in this talk, but if you're interested, Jeremy Questel is going to give a talk right after mine in which he explains more about this object. So this object is not totally well understood. We don't have, an equation that describes the KPZ fixed point, but this is believed to be the universal limit of this system as well as other nonlinear type growth processes as well as many other systems.
But under the 3-2-1 scaling is exact at this fixed point?
The
3-2-1 scaling is exact at this fixed point?
Yeah, this is the scaling that brings you to the fixed point and then it's fixed under that scaling. Yeah. Okay. So this scaling, this 3-2-1 scaling, this is the prediction that Kadar, Prezi, and Zhang made in their paper. It actually went back to an earlier paper, 1977, of Forrester, Nelson, and Stevens. So in a sense, next year we can celebrate the 40th anniversary of KPZ. Okay. So let me get a little bit more out of this. There's more that we can get out of this, the way that the KPZ equation scales. So we saw some prediction for how it should behave in its long time limit. But there is something which can be called or termed weak universality of the KPZ equation. And this is the following idea. So, we have this KPZ fixed point. And you see that you have the KPZ equation. Now, if you start tuning parameters of the KPZ equation, you can get all sorts of other things. You can start to throw out the noise, and then you get the Viscous-Burgers equation. You can throw out the nonlinearity. Then you get the stochastic heat equation with additive noise. So the KPZ equation is crossing over between lots of different objects and this fixed point. So we know that under this 3-2-1 scaling, you're supposed to be converging to this fixed point. Now, one thing that you can do is you can do some scalings, but simultaneously rescale coefficients. In such a way that the KPZ equation remains fixed. So weak universality is that I'm going to explain to you a few scalings of the equation and its coefficients, which remain fixed, under which it remains fixed. And then weak universality says that if you look at a microscopic system and you apply the same sort of rescaling as well as rescaling coefficients or parameters of the model, then you should actually get to the KPZ equation. So there are two weak scalings that I'll just mention, and then I'll substantiate them through examples. So the first I'll call weak nonlinearity scaling. So this has, if I choose b to be a half and z to be 2, so this means that I look at a time scale which is the square of the space scale, and then a fluctuation scale, which is, again, the square root of the space scale, so the usual diffusive scaling. Now, if I do that, I find that that this term behaves like epsilon to the 0, this term behaves like epsilon to 0, but this term behaves like epsilon to the minus a half. In other words, under this scaling, I've kind of gone so long in time that my nonlinearity is really, really blowing up. So the natural thing I can do is I can take my nonlinearity, and I can actually tune it with epsilon to be epsilon to the 1/2 times some lambda twiddle. And under this scaling, the KPZ equation remains invariant. Now, this, of course, is obvious, right? Okay. Anyway, let me spend another moment telling you something else that's obvious. Weak noise scaling. So the same sort of deal, except now I'm going to do b is 0, z is 2. And I'm going to choose the beta, depend on epsilon. And again, if you plug in these two values, you find that the noise is blowing up. So I ought to take the noise to 0 in a suitable way with a coefficient. Okay. Now, the thing that's nice about these is that these are cranks that keep the KPZ equation invariant. So now I can explain to you how certain discrete models, if you apply the same scalings and the same weak nonlinear or weak noise scaling, you get the KPZ equation. So here's an example. Here's examples. So consider now some generic function f, which I'll say will be an even polynomial. And let's look at the kind of KPZ equation with more general nonlinearity. Lambda, and I'm going to put a lambda epsilon. And then this will be a function of the gradient plus noise. And I'm going to assume for the moment that this is smooth in space. Say smooth to order 1. So this is a perfectly well-defined object. Now I'm going to apply the weak nonlinearity scaling. So apply this weak nonlinearity scaling. And that means to tune this lambda to 0. In the according way, and to do all of these scalings. And then Heyer and Questel have proved that as epsilon goes to 0, all that you get, you don't actually see the nonlinearity, you get back the KPZ equation. You get back the regular old KPZ equation with space-time white noise, except that the residual effect of this function f is that the nonlinearity in the KPZ equation is actually equal to 1/2 the derivative of the second the integral of the second derivative of this function f against the Gaussian measure. So this is the Gaussian measure. In other words, it's a coefficient in a Hermite polynomial expansion of the function f. So you see that even you know, you might expect if this is something like a square plus a quadratic term, only to see the square term, but that's not the case. Because you really are seeing all order terms in this expression. Okay, so this was one example of how you see this sort of scaling invariance occurring in a discrete system. Or kind of. Let me give you a more discrete object, which is another example of this weak nonlinearity scaling. So this is for something called the asymmetric simple exclusion process. Herbert actually spoke about this processing some length in his Blackboard talk, but I'll just be brief. So imagine that you have a stepped interface, which is composed of plus and minus one sloped line segments. Okay, so this could be some domain wall boundary in some sort of planar model. And I have a time dynamic, by which I take minimums and I turn them into maximums. So here was the minimum. And I do the opposite. And so this occurs at rate t. So according to an exponential clock of rate t. And this occurs at rate q. So in other words, simultaneously, I'm thinking about inverting these, or bringing this down, or bringing this up. And there are little clocks associated to each one of these events. And whenever it rings, one of these things happens. Okay. Now this defines for me a height function, some discrete height function. And there's a theorem from the late 90s, or mid to late 90s, of Bertini and Jacquemin that says that if I take this process and I define my lambda epsilon to be p minus q, the epsilon to the 1/2. So in other words, I take a system in which the asymmetry, the difference between growing and removing particles, is going to zero. And then I apply the exact same weak nonlinearity scaling. I take a very long time, epsilon to the minus 2. Yeah, I look at space of order epsilon to the minus 1, and I scale the whole height function by epsilon to the 1/2. Then under that scaling, in this choice of simultaneously rescaling the nonlinearity, my function h, my interface function h, converges to a solution to the KPC equation. Of course, the initial data, in all cases, you need to look at the limit of the initial data as well. Okay. Now, this, of course, should hold for more general classes of random growth processes. Of course, proving this is some challenge. But under the scaling where you kind of look at the microscopic version of the nonlinearity, which is very naturally here, this difference between p and q, and you scale it to zero. So those are examples of where you see the...
But presumably any microscopic model which has the same symmetries and some nonlinearity present will scale onto the KPC fixed point in the sense that b equals 1/2, z equals 3/2.
That's right. So the real universality conjecture is that you have any of these models which have these kind of four properties I mentioned, this locality smoothing, some microscopic version of nonlinear dependence on slope and some noise, will under this 3-2-1 scaling go to this universal KPC fixed point.
What you're trying to prove is that various different microscopic models indeed do that.
What we'd really want to prove is that, but it's very hard because honestly our understanding of what this limiting object even is not spectacular. We understand certain statistical properties of it, but we don't have a theory that describes its kind of basin of attraction. So a kind of weaker version of that idea is that you look at those systems and you also tune them to this sort of critical crossover scale in which you see the KPC equation itself, which is this sort of crossover mechanism between various other universality classes, including this KPC one. Okay, let me indulge you a little bit about weak noise, and this will give you a sense of what this weak noise scaling gives. And it will also give you another incarnation of the KPC equation. So we've seen this KPC equation as a random growing interface model. But it turns out that you can also, by a Feynman path integral, you can represent the exponential, which we already identified as the solution to the stochastic heat equation. If you apply the Feynman-Katz integral representation to this, or path representation, and you think of this as a random potential, then you find that this is equal to the expectation with respect to a Brownian motion, which is started at time t at position x. So let me draw you a picture. So I have time t. I look at position x. I take a Brownian motion backwards in time. It hits somewhere. This is time 0. I have space-time white noise. And I'm going to look at the initial data sampled by the Brownian motion at time 0, and then the exponential. And I'll put some dots to represent that this is a Wick-ordered exponential, which just means that there's some renormalization that's required to define it. And then the path integral through the space-time white noise field. And I may have been a little lazy and dropped some of these lambdas and nus here, but you, again, you shouldn't worry because you can always scale them in and out, okay? So the picture is really that you have this noise field and you're looking according to some random trajectory, you're eating up the noise, you're treating that as some sort of energy of a path, you're exponentiating it, that gives you the Boltzmann weight of the path, and this is like a partition function for that sort of statistical object, some sort of equilibrium statistical object, in fact. So here, a natural way of understanding this weak noise scaling is to say, let's discretize the whole picture and ask, how does the discrete system converge to the continuum system? And you'll see that it's exactly under this weak noise scaling. So to discretize, So we're going to discretize the system, and we'll replace, so we'll define some h tilde, tx, this is now on a discrete lattice, as log z tilde tx, where this z tilde will now be the expectation with respect to a random walk that at time t is at position x, the same sort of object. So, you know, some initial data, and then the exponential of the sum along the trajectory, I equals 0 to t, of some noises. So the picture is just the pure discretization. It's that you start here and you have some random walk trajectory back in time, 0, and then at every lattice point, you have some field of IID, W, IX, which are going to be independent random variables. And then you can ask, how does this discrete, what's called polymer partition function, this discrete model converge to the continuum? And the natural thing is to just, well, how does the path converge to the continuum path? It's under diffusive scaling, which is to choose, in other words, B is equal to 0 and Z is equal to 2. And then how does the noise field? Well, if you take this IID system of noise and you start smooshing it back together, you need to weaken it in order to get a continuum limit. And that's exactly what we're seeing by choosing this weak noise scale. Now, if you, again, going back to the question of if you had just applied the KPC scaling, the 3-2-1 scaling, to this object at a fixed beta, you again conjecture that the free energy of the model, the log of z, should go to this KPC fixed point. But that's only been proved for very, very particular models. It's not a general result. So it's very widely conjectured, but it hasn't been proved. So the result which I just mentioned was due to Alberts, Kahn, and Costell about 3 or 4 years ago, by which the discrete goes to the continuum. Okay, so I want to now turn to the question of how does the KPC equation really behave in its long time limit. In other words, I want to study a little bit more about this KPC fixed point. So I've made some sense of what this equation is doing, how does it arise. Now I want to explain to you really mathematically or exactly how you can start to analyze this KPC equation and gain access to its fixed point. Because a priori, if I told you, you know, here's the KPC equation, tell me what does it look like in long time. You know, it's very hard to get your hands on it. You can do numerics. There are methods like mode coupling. There's functional renormalization group. These methods start to give you some information, not rigorously, but they give you some information. But really, we want to get our hands on the statistics. We want to know what is the distribution of this height function at a given time, given some initial data. And then what does it behave like in long time? Okay, so this brings us to our third topic, which is how does it behave? Now, the natural thing to do is to just try to stare at the equation and say, okay, you know, what do you tell me? Now, he's not going to tell you very much. Even if somehow somebody gave you a formula for the distribution of this equation at time t position x, you couldn't verify it. Because you don't, it's not like a PDE where somebody gives you the solution and then you just plug it in. If somebody gives you the marginal distribution of this random massive point field at one point, there's no kind of way of just confirming it. So there's no guess and check here. So we need to get some handle on a mathematical structure that sits behind this equation.
There's no ability turn this into an equation for the probability distribution.
Not that I know. That'd be wonderful if there was, but no. So the way that we're going to get our hands on this is through studying the moments, not of H, but of its exponential. In other words, of the stochastic heat equation. And the surprise structure will be that the moments of the stochastic heat equation satisfy a quantum integral system. Okay. Now, there will be some mathematical impediments along the way towards this. And one of the things that has been developed on the mathematical side is ways of really proceeding and understanding these structures at a higher level so as to both generalize them and also rigorize them. Okay. But let's proceed. So I want to describe to you the method of studying these polymers or the stochastic heat equation or a KPZ equation via replicas. Now it's not, you shouldn't get scared, this isn't, you know, really Parisi replica. This is a simple thing. My brother works on Parisi replicas. I told him this and he said, no, you know, this is nothing compared to what I work on. Anyway, it's sibling rivalries. But so we're going to define this, I'll call it Z bar to represent average, T, and then a vector. And this vector will be a vector of spatial locations x1 through xn. And this is just by definition the expected value, and this is the expected value with respect to the noise of the product of the solution to the stochastic heat equation at position xi at time t for I equals 1 to n. So in other words, I exponentiate the KPZ equation, I solve this, I run this evolution up to time t, I sample it at n different deterministic locations, it's a random object, and I look at the moment. I look at the expectation of that product. Now, I'm going to go through a brief calculation, which, of course, one should never do, but I'll do it on the board anyway. Now, how is it that we're going to start to understand this object? Well, we know that each of these z's has a path integral representation, which I just wrote down here. Now, we're going to use path integral representations for each of these z's, but with different Brownian motions for each z. So this thing is equal to this, again, this expectation, and now I'll write a kind of n-fold expectation with respect to a vector of Brownian motions, which all start off at the vector given by x at time t. So I have, you know, b1 starts off at x1, and so on and so forth. And then I have my terms that I would have. So I have the product of the initial data sampled at bi at time 0, I equals 1 to n. And then I have my noise terms, which integral 0 to t, sum, I equals 1 to n, of these path integrals through the space-time white noise field. Now I'm going to interchange these two expectations and use the following fact, which is that if I have the expectation of e to k times a normal random variable minus its variance over 2, then this is equal to e to the variance times k choose 2. In other words, k minus 1 over 2. So this will be a normal 0 sigma squared variance, random variable. So what I'll do is I'm going to bring this expectation inside. Now, space-time white noise is independent in space and time. So all I need to watch out for is there might be some locations where the b's are the same. If the b's are the same for a little instant of time dt, I'm not just looking at a single normal random variable, but I'm actually looking at, you know, if there are k of them together, k of these normal random variables. Now, there was this subtraction of sigma squared over 2. This is the thing that I needed to really, that's what the dots meant. So just bear with me. So what happens is that once I take this expectation inside, evaluate the disordered expectation, I get out a deterministic function, which is this k or this n-fold path integral expectation of, again, the initial data, times now the exponential of the integral sum of the delta functions, so that bi at time s minus bj at time s the s are equal to I less than j. Okay. What I've done is I've just rewritten that, you know, if I have a cluster of k things together, well, and I get a k choose 2, then another way of doing it is just counting the number of pairs that are together. They're same. So another interpretation of this object up here is that this is the pairwise local time of a collection of n independent Brownian motions. And this is the exponential of that. Okay. Now, the beautiful fact is that I can then reapply the Feynman-Katz or the Feynman path integral, and I find that my dt z actually solves the equation with h equal to 1/2 the Laplacian, the n-fold Laplacian, so xi, xi, plus some I less than j of this delta field, xi minus xj. Now this object, h, is the Hamiltonian of the imaginary time attractive delta Bose gas. If I had a negative sign, it would be the repulsive, and if I had an I, it would be real time. So this is a quantum integrable system that was studied by Lieb and Linegar, and they showed that you can apply, or in fact, they kind of rediscovered beta ansatz to diagonalize this system. Now, there's still quite a lot of work to be done, but what this means effectively is that you can use certain technology to write down exact formulas for the evolution of this given any initial data. Now, how nice those formulas will depend a little bit on the initial data. But we see now that we can compute these moment formulas. So let me actually just write it down for you to give you a flavor. These formulas are actually not what I would call horrendous. I'll give you them in the form that I like it the most, which is that you get this by applying certain methods of beta ansatz. Now, I'm going to only write the formula down for the ordered set x1 less than or equal to xn. Now, of course, you say this is stupid because this thing is symmetric, but the right-hand side won't be symmetric. Okay? So this is equal to the integral. So it's an n-fold expectation, so it's actually going to be an n-fold integral. And then you have term that corresponds to the so-called S matrix, so product A, little a, b less than n. And then you have the free propagator. In other words, I'll tell you the contours in a moment. In other words, if I just had the equation with only the Laplacian, you wouldn't have this term. And this term takes into account the delta interaction. The contours are vertical lines, which are shifted. So here's z1 through zn. They're shifted by at least one. So they're at least one apart. So they're far enough apart to avoid any poles of this denominator. It's actually, once you've written this formula down, it's very simple to check that it satisfies it. So whereas computing the distribution of KPZ and checking it, this is a formula for some sort of functional of this distribution, which is easy to check. Okay. Now, what can we use this for, though? Well, you might hope that this contains the entire distribution of Z and would be able to be used to recover it. But one knows from certain examples, for instance, there is this thing called the log normal distribution, whose moments do not determine its distribution. This is kind of a very classical example of a probability distribution whose moment problem is not well posed. It turns out that the solution to the stochastic heat equation also yields a moment problem which is not well posed. So whereas one would like to recover the distribution from this, you run into some problems. I'll explain to you just a little while later that there are ways to get around that. Essentially, the ways to get around it are to look for discretizations of the KPZ equation and of the structure for which you no longer run into this problem. And this will bring you into some interesting mathematics. But let's keep running with this equation for the moment, though. So I want to tell you at a kind of a non-mathematically rigorous level, what are some calculations that you can do to gain information about the KPZ equation from what we've done right here. Okay? So the first thing that you can use this for is to study the so-called Lyapunov exponents. Now, that's just a fancy way of saying how big are the moments. So I'll define gamma n as I'm going to look at the nth moment of z I'll assume some, so here I've assumed an initial data. This is for initial data, which is a delta function. But you can write formulas, albeit sometimes more complicated for other initial data. So I'll look at the nth moment of z. Now that will grow exponentially. And so the natural thing to do is to look at the logarithm of that, divide by t, and then take t to infinity. Now, from this type of formula, it's actually very easy to see how this will grow. What happens is the following. And for those who know beta ansatz, you'll see something familiar. If you want to study asymptotics of this integral, you need to bring all of the contours together, because you need to bring them to steepest descent contours for these types of integrals. Now, as you bring them together, you encounter residues coming from the denominator. And these residues take the form of strings. So if you know the string solutions for this delta Bose gas in the attractive case, that's exactly how this comes out of this type of formula. So you bring these together and you find that the ground state is the string in which you specialize all of the z's into 1 plus the previous z. In other words, you are left with a single integral in the ground state energy. And by computing that, you get a formula that the Lyapunov exponent is n times n squared minus 1 over 24. It's actually a very simple calculation, and it just comes out of the structure of this integral and the string states. So what this is really telling you about is it's telling you about how does the really, really far tails of z behave. In other words, you know, z is decaying to zero, very far out, the probability, but it decays in such a way that the first moment and the second moment and the third moment feel further and further parts of the distribution. So these moments and these Lyapunov exponents are really telling you about the tails of z, or by logarithm, the tails of h. But it doesn't tell you about the distribution itself. Now, I want to show you one calculation. This is a non-rigorous calculation. It's called the n goes to zero replica trick. N goes to zero trick. You may have seen this one before, but I'll apply it here. And you'll see it's rather cute and also rather slick. So we know that log of z can be written as the limit as n goes to 0, so assuming n is real valued, of z to the n minus 1 over n. So now let's apply that to the random variable z. So let's compute the limit as t goes to infinity. So rather than looking at the expectation, or the log of the expectation, I'm going to look at the solution to the KPC equation, which is the log of z, and I'm going to look at its expectation. So I want to just know how does h behave in a long period of time? It's this randomly growing, fluctuating thing. Does it stay stationary? Does it drift in some direction? So that's what this is going to compute. So now I plug in my little formula here. I'm going to bring the expectation inside. So I still have my t goes to infinity, my 1 over t. Then I have my limit n goes to 0, and my nth moment. I'll drop the t0 here. Minus 1 over n. Now, here's something which I'm going to do. You'll see it's a little weird. We know that this is equal to, for a very long time, this is equal to something like e to the t gamma n. Right? That was the calculation I just did. But now let me imagine that this made sense for non-integer n. Because after all, I only know these formulas for integer n. And let me assume, moreover, that I'm kind of going to expand around n equals 0 and keep t fixed. Now, if I do that, then this is approximately 1 plus t times gamma n. Now, let me just plug that in into here. Okay, so I'm going to get back this 1 over, so I have my lim, I have my 1 over t, and then my lim in n. And then the 1's cancel, and I get my t times the gamma n, but gamma n is n times n squared minus 1 over 24. Then I have my final n. The n's cancel, the t's cancel. I set little n equals to 0. I get 0 minus 1 over 24. And in the end, this is equal to minus 1 over 24. Okay. Miraculously, this is true. This is the correct answer. This is very far from a proof of that, though. Now, how might one go about proving such a thing, or actually getting a little bit further into the distribution? Well, you know, the natural thing to do would be to study to try to study the something like the Laplace transform. So if you wanted to go further, you could try to compute the Laplace transform of this solution. So if you wanted to compute the Laplace transform, you know, you naturally would Taylor expand this exponential and then try to interchange the expectation with the summation. Because after all, we only know formulas for moments. If we know the Laplace transform of a positive random variable, we can invert it and we can get its distribution. So this is equal to the sum of zeta d n over n factorial, and then this expectation t0, the nth power. Now, it's not actually equal to that, because this is infinity. We've just checked that these moments grow like e to the n cubed. So there's no radius of convergence. There's no sense in which this is a convergent series. But on the other hand, it's because of this interchange of expectation and summation. So you might think that the story's over there. But in fact, a few years ago, so about five or six years ago, there were two groups of physicists who are represented here, so Calabresi, Lidusol, and Rosso, as well as Viktor Dobzhenko, who took this formula, took these formulas on the right-hand side, this type of formula or various versions of this, and started to reorder the right-hand side. And reordered it in such a way as to finally get a finite sum, finite formula, and they, you know, skipping this in a sense, they got a formula for this Laplace transform as a determinant, actually as a Fredholm determinant. Now that formula, the left-hand and the right-hand side in the end made sense, and it turns out that it was actually correct. And this was something which Sasamoto and Spohn and Gidi Amir, Jeremy Questel, and myself had found from another approach at the same time by studying Tracy and Widom's ASAP formulas. And actually we had proved with Amir and Questel this formula. So you see that even though there is this sort of very illegal step going on, and or here is kind of very suspect, non-rigorous things going on, you still get the correct answers in the end. Now, the output of all of this story, because I should start to come to a close, is that once you have, one way or another, computed the distribution using these moments using another approach of the solution to the stochastic heat equation or the KPC equation, you can prove the following theorem, which describes its long-time behavior. So we're going to look at log of z, again, for this delta initial data, which I'll call h. When you look at the height function at time t, the first thing is that it grows, as we said, like t to the minus, or like t times minus 1 over 24. So if I want to look at the height function, so I have this sort of randomly growing thing, over time it's actually decreasing in height at a speed minus t over 24. So I need to add that back in. And once I've added that back in, then I need to rescale. And it turns out I need to rescale by t to the 1/3. And this should be familiar because this is exactly the 3-2-1 scaling. You're seeing the 1 and the 3 coming in. Time is like t. So time is like three thirds, and so fluctuation to like 1/3. And then what we proved is that this random variable converges as t goes to infinity to the Tracy-Widom GUE distribution. In other words, now this is a little surprising at first if you haven't seen such a result before. You look at this randomly growing interface in a long time under the KPZ scaling, this 3-2-1 scaling. There's this random interface, it overall moves down, and after a while, it will have large fluctuations, which are order t to the 1/3, and have this random matrix type distribution. And this wasn't the first model in this KPC class for which one had shown this. There are models like ASAP with p equals 1 and q equals 0, for which this had been shown. But this proves, or at least demonstrates, that the KPC equation is, in fact, in the KPC universality class, which is... It should be, but at least, well, it wasn't known. Okay, so in the remaining two or three minutes, I want to zoom out a little bit. Okay, now, you know, I've explained to you how by using this structure, this connection to the delta Bose gas, you can really get some traction, but you run into some impediments, at least mathematically. Now, I'm going to steal an analogy that Alexei Borodin gave in a talk about 2 weeks ago, which is that you should think of this as you're in a valley, and it's a very fertile valley. But maybe you've kind of exhausted the land there. So what do you do? What's the natural thing to do is to go and find the highest mountain and hike up to the top of that mountain and look around for other valleys that you can inhabit. So the natural thing mathematically here is to look for that mountain. And the mountain is the structure. The structure is quantum integrable systems. So systems for which you can diagonalize multi, you know, many body systems explicitly. And so what happens is we've found generalizations or discretizations of the KPZ equation coming from the structure of quantum integrable systems, algebraic beta ansatz, for which the whole story goes through. And in the end, when you generalize it to the top of the mountain, it's very cold up there, and no one wants to be up there because these are complicated systems. But you see knots of nice degeneration. So you see degenerations to things like directed polymer models, which are exactly solvable, to things like random walks in random environments, things like tiling models, all sorts of systems that you initially might not have thought fall into this class, you can see when you're on the top of the mountain. So that's one of the directions of generalization. There are other mountaintops.
Soluble by beta ansatz, is that what you're saying?
Yeah, so you find basically probabilistic systems which are, in a sense, dual to quantum integral systems solvable by beta ansatz. Okay. Now, there is actually another hidden structure which I haven't really discussed at all behind the KPZ equation, which might appeal actually to maybe the Sheets type people, which is that the KPZ equation can actually be realized as the top curve of an infinite ensemble of curves that, in some sense, are elastic curves, so it forms some sort of discrete sheet, something like a smectic. It's not a smectic, but it has the flavor of one, where the relative curves interact with some exponential energy. So there is this ensemble, an infinite ensemble of curves which are background Brownian, interacting with their consecutively labeled, you know, their nearest neighbor labeled curves in an exponential energetic constraint. Basically, you don't like crossing the curve above you or below you. You'd like to stay in order. This thing goes down to infinity. The top curve is actually the solution to the KPZ equation. So seeing that structure is actually very hard.
Seeing that structure where?
Well, it's very hard to see that structure. In fact, that structure comes from a mountaintop, which is something called McDonald processes. So it's an area which is based on a different kind of field of representation theory, which is symmetric function theory. So in the end, there are these other structures which give rise to the solvability of systems and which have kind of surprising implications. So I'll just give you the little diagram, which is you have here quantum integrable systems. You have here things like symmetric functions. And these structures give rise to integral probability, which, in other words, are probabilistic systems, right? Sometimes equilibrium, sometimes non-equilibrium systems, which are exactly solvable. And it's these structures, and once you understand one, you want to hike to the mountaintop and then see where what else can degenerate down. So a lot of the interest within mathematics has come from this direction, as well as from the direction of understanding the structures behind actually making sense of these stochastic PDEs, as I mentioned, Martin Heyer's work and various others. Okay, so just to end, the outlook and what we've kind of seen in the program is we've seen a lot of work in exploiting these types of structures, in understanding the weak universality of the KPZ equation, expanding that weak scope. Also, and this is a hard question, is to understand the real universality of the equation, showing that real systems under generic 3-to-1 scaling go to the KPZ fixed point. And then also understanding how to expand the scope to higher dimensions, to higher multi-component systems, complex noise, and various other applications. Okay, well, thank you very much.
Have numerical simulations been helpful? I mean, just a straight, you know, integration of the stochastic integration of the KPZ equation.
Yeah, definitely. So there was, you know, for instance, in the early 90s, there was quite a lot of work on studying the probability amplitude, getting even before some of these, you know, these random matrix type distributions had really been analytically written down. There were graphs that kind of come out of this. You need to be careful in how you integrate this or how you numerically represent it because of these questions of how to actually define the PDE, the SPDE. This is kind of a question in the sense of numerics. But you can definitely do that. And this is...
Please. Beyond mathematical physics as a model of real processes, is it successful? I mean, does it successfully describe something?
Yeah. So somebody sitting right behind you did an experiment. Takeuchi and Sano did a very nice experiment involving liquid crystal, so a pneumatic disorder of liquid crystal. Has two, I'm not going to explain it nearly as well as he will, but it has two different disordered states, one which is more stable than the other, I suppose. You start it in the less stable state, you shoot a laser into the middle of it, then it precipitates a growing blob, and you repeat that many times. You look at around its shape what the fluctuations are as a function of time, and you get this. Well, this and this. That's one example. There are other types of examples. Of course, it's very hard, in totally, like real growing processes, you go and look at the shore of the ocean or something. It's very hard to really get good numbers on this. But this was one example where you could really repeat the experiment sufficiently to get even the distribution.
Let me add, you mentioned higher dimensionality. Mm-hmm. So, there's a long-standing astrophysical problem of how white dwarfs explode under deflagration waves, where there's a local deflagration speed, which looks much like some of this, but it's in three dimensions. And there's noise because it's acting in a turbulent environment where you can just get advection due to turbulence. So is there any prospect for where you're tracking a planar surface?
There are definitely numerics. So Tim Halpin Healy, who was here in the beginning of the program, has done a lot of numerics recently. There is, if you're looking at a kind of a two-dimensional surface growing in three dimensions, it seems that the exponents that describe the fluctuations are not one-third, but something like 0.2401, not 0.24, but... there are some graphs or plots of the kind of the empirical distribution that you get, and tails seem to be a little bit more nicer than kind of trying to understand the bulk of the distribution. But mathematically, it's we don't yet have any handle on a structure that's going to give us real exact formulas there. One dimension is very important here because you're dealing with quantum integral systems. And they really rely, in a sense, on the fact that you can't move two particles around each other without crossing each other.
So most of the systems you have shown us and the computations, they have something to do with integrability. But the KPC class should be much...
That's right. The KPC class is...
Should be exceptional. Do we know any systems or PDEs which are definitely not integrable?
Which have been proved to be kind of... So it depends, what level of membership you want in the KPC class. So, a weaker form of membership in the KPC class is to be able to prove that you at least have the right scaling exponents. So there are systems. So for instance, there are systems. So Timo Saplanen gave a nice talk about this during the program. So if you look at what are called zero-range processes, you just have stacks of particles sitting on the integer line. You can have arbitrary number of particles per stack, per location. And the rule is that at each location, independently, you move one particle to the left. But you do it as a function of the height. So, maybe if the height is larger, you move it faster or something like that. So for generic, fairly generic choices of this moving, this rate function, they were able to show that in the kind of invariant initial data, which is just a product measure on the state space, you have that the kind of current of particles to move past a given line has the correct scale fluctuation. So that's a non-integral system. It's still nice because you know the invariant measure explicitly. So that gives you a lot to work with. But, that's one example of a system. But certainly, yeah. It's actually very different than in the classical sense of integrability. In the classical sense of integrability, integral systems are also exceptional, but their behavior is also exceptional. You have all these infinite conserved quantities and stuff like this. Within stochastic integrability, or this integral probability, the integral probabilistic systems are still exceptional, but their behaviors are universal. Okay? So, there are these kind of points at which you can really understand the universality classes.
Thanks, Ivan.